Good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the Agriculture Show. It's a Tuesday afternoon here in lovely uptown Waterloo, and we're just so glad you tuned in. And today's guest is Mr. Tom Woodcock. Good morning, Tom.
Hello, how are you?
Good. I guess I should say good afternoon.
Good afternoon, yeah.
Tom, you've been so good. You brought along four great tunes to play today. Let's play the very first one here. I guess if it's okay with you, I guess it's Johnny Appleseed.
Yep. Yeah.
Tell us where you heard that song. Why you picked that one?
Well, one of my favorite musicians ever since long as I can remember is Joe Strummer.
Yeah.
From the Clash. So that was his post Clash musical efforts, the Mescaleros. So it's off their second album and has a bit of an agricultural theme.
And agriculture is our business today.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, we're going to play Tom's first selection here. Tom is from Rare Agricultural Reserve over in Cambridge. We'll talk a lot more about that when we come back. Stay tuned, stay locked in, and we'll see you in a short bit.
We'll be right back. This is Devin Homick from the Delhi location, FS Partners. You're listening to The Agricultural Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM. The Agricultural Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the needs of the society.
Hi, this is Krista Halsoff from Veld Architect and Our Farm. We would like to invite you to come listen to Mark Shepherd give a workshop on October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Waterloo, Ontario. You are listening to The Agriculture Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM.
And once again, thanks for listening in, folks. I hope you enjoy your show today. We always have great shows and great guests. And if you had listened there, you heard a promo from Krista, who's running a workshop starting tonight and tomorrow, no, 2nd and 3rd. That's Wednesday. Yeah, I look on my guest today to help keep me on track.
Thursday and Friday.
Thursday and Friday, okay. See, that's why you have a good guest, because they keep you on a straight and narrow. And Tom has pointed out that I should have probably have said it's a rare charitable reserve.
Rare charitable research reserve.
Research reserve. I can't even get it right like that. How you like that? Now, once again, folks, my guest today is Tom Woodcock, and we're going to talk about what's happening over at Rare, and we're going to talk a little bit about how that fits in agriculture. But first, we're going to get to know Tom a little bit. And we were just out in the parking lot before the show and observing the change in weather. How does that affect you guys over at Rare these days?
Well, we've been enjoying the rain, particularly today, because there's a lot of tree planting and restoration work we've been doing really over the past few weeks. And, of course, we planting in some pretty hard soil, so the more rain we get,
the easier the digging.
Like it.
How did you end up at Rare? What's your story, Tom? Are you a local kid, or where were you born and raised at?
Yeah, I'm sort of local. I was born in Toronto, moved to Brantford, Ontario, when I was about 7 years old, and spent the rest of my, I guess, childhood, you can call it, there, and attended the University of Guelph after I finished high school, where I went to the Ontario Agriculture College and majored in environmental biology. So
that's a good choice.
Did a lot of work on pest control and plant pathology and entomology, and I really gravitated towards entomology. I liked insects a lot when I was younger, and had a really good faculty member there who sort of rekindled that interest in a more adult way, rather than just filling my parents' house with escaped flies and spiders and whatnot. So after I finished that, I worked in private consulting for a while, doing entomology and water related stuff, and I really enjoyed that. So I did that for about 2.5 years, and we had a fellow who worked there with us who went back to school and did a master's degree, and he was having so much fun doing that. Mm-hmm. I sort of blame him for making the choice to go back to school myself. So I ended up moving to the U.S., to the University of Maine, and started doing a master's degree and ended up turning into a PhD, and I was there for about 5 years, and I was working on water pollution from various sources. Basically, I got there to do this master's project, and it's a small town on the coast of Maine called Saco, and they have a little stream that runs through them, and upstream of the town it was really nice and clean, and downstream it was pretty much dead. So the project was find out what happened. So I worked on that for a couple years, and found the culprit, which was an industrial culprit that was discharging an awful lot of nasty metals into the water. Mm-hmm. But I liked that work so much that I decided I wanted to stay on and study some other streams in that area. So I ended up doing a PhD there and in water pollution from roadways and how that affects streams. And following that, I moved on to upstate New York in the Adirondack Mountains and worked on a forest management project there, really looking at legislative designations for land use in the Adirondack Park.
Okay.
They have a variety, mostly forestry. There's not a whole lot of agriculture goes on in the Adirondacks. People have tried to to farm things, and outside of cattle, there's not a whole lot you can do. People try to grow potatoes without much success. But so we're looking at these legislative designations of forest preserve and resource management land, which was the term they give to forestry and so on. And the question was really, did those designations mean anything? Did these styles of land management, no matter what was happening, actually translate to, you know, effects, positive or negative, on things like water quality and habitat quality for wildlife and plant diversity and all those sorts of things. So that was a good project. That was about 3 years. I spent there in upstate New York. And following that, I decided I wanted to move back to Canada. I was a little fed up with the U.S.
It's very controversial.
There was a lot going on there in the 2004-2005 kind of time period. So I moved back here and ended up teaching at Wilfrid Laurier University for 4 years. And that's when I ended up moving to Waterloo. I expected I would be staying at Laurier long term, and that didn't happen. So following that job, I ended up working at the University of Guelph again. So I came full circle and went to work at the Canadian Pollination Initiative, which was what they call a strategic network to address pollination problems, the high-profile ones, which includes the losses of honeybees, but also all aspects from plant reproduction, agricultural or not, and right the way up to ecosystems and even sort of long-term predictions of what might happen to insects and plants and those sorts of things. So that was still working on some of that stuff, actually. And while I was there, I started doing a research project at the Rare Charitable Research Reserve, which I'd known for quite some time. And I studied pollination there on agricultural lands that had been taken out of production for research purposes, largely, or stewardship purposes, and looking at the plant communities as they reassembled on those lands and the pollinator communities with them. And I still have some work to do getting that work finished up, because science isn't finished till it's published, right? So, so still got a bit to do there. And following that, I just saw there was a position available at Rare, so I really, really grew to like the land. And that area, so I applied for it, and for better or for worse, here I am. I've only been working there for about 6 weeks now, but
oh my goodness, they threw you right in the fire to be on this show today. Well, they couldn't have picked a better person to come on, Tom. I just listened to your just amazing history of research and the things you've been involved with. They could all be great shows. You have so much experience of pollination, and so your last topic is one that's really current nowadays. It certainly is. So are you a family man, or have you had a chance to raise a family in the midst of all this moving around?
Yeah, I have a wife imported from the U.S. As well, and we have a almost 7-year-old daughter.
Oh, my. I bet she doesn't have any trouble coming to work with you once in a while if you were so let her.
Yeah, she haven't managed to do that sort of take your daughter to work day or anything yet, but maybe someday. We did have our main fundraiser at Rare, the walk and run for Rare this past weekend, and where people walk a route through the property, or there was also a 5K run, and they did that, and Iris set a goal, my daughter set a goal of raising $100 for Rare, and she actually made it, so that was, she was pretty tired at the end of walking 5Ks.
Well, that's a lot for a little 7-year-old legs to go that distance.
Yeah.
Wow. This is excellent. I'm so glad you could give us such a great history of yourself and how you end up at Rare Charitable Research Reserve. Oh, look at that. I get the thumbs up from the guest. I'm just doing A1 here right now. Mm-hmm. This is great for our show. We'll talk a little bit more about Rare in our second segment, and third and fourth we'll cover some other agricultural stuff. So let's play another song. Let's just review that first song. That was a song called Johnny Appleseed, and that was by...
Joe Strummer and the Mescaleros.
And the Mescaleros. Certainly not in a group you'd associate with Johnny Appleseed, since that's a rich historical, folksy type of a history of that man spreading around apples. Where'd you hear that song? I know you took some effort to pick these songs today. Where'd you first hear that song?
Well, that was... geez, like I said, Joe Strummer has been one of my favorites. He was the front man for The Clash, and I've loved The Clash probably since I was 9 or 10 years old, if I go back that far. So they broke up in, well, really in 82, although they did produce a substandard album a little later on in 85. And Joe Strummer kicked around a lot. He did some solo work. He worked with the Pogues for a bit, which is a band with where their front man had noted alcohol problems, so he filled in. And then he had the Mescaleros, and unfortunately Joe died at a young age from previously undetected congenital heart problem. He died at age 50, which was far too young for such a great guy. So the Mescaleros' third album came out posthumously. And that was from their second album. So so he did tour that one, but he didn't get to tour the last one, unfortunately. And I never got to see him. So
yeah, it's always a shame when you have an artist like that. You don't get to see him before they move on or pass away, whatever. I see Cat Stevens in the paper the other day. He's renamed himself and refused to have a concert in New York City. Because now he has a new view on life and decided he'd live with his new value system. And
Yeah, he's a tough one to keep up with, too.
Well, we'll play another song here. We'll talk a bit about afterwards, I suppose, but before we play it, this is the a song called Boatman. You want to just give us a quick little idea what this one's about?
Boatman by The Levellers, which is another one of my favorite bands, British sort of folk rock band. Boatman, I thought, is a good way to... Well, their song is really about how... Just how to live your life, life for yourself, and be good to people, and not do no harm. I guess is their philosophy, which I think is a good one to have in music or life or land management.
Yeah, or at rare charitable research. I should write this down.
Reserve.
I should write the full thing out so I don't have to look over my shoulder. So with that little promo, we'll play that song, and just stay tuned, folks. We're having a great time today. Got some great music, got a great guest. And it's the Agriculture Show, and this is episode 90 and on September the 30th of 2014.
The life I please, then I would be a boatman on the canals and the rivers free. No hasty words are spoken. My only law is the river breeze that takes me to the open seas. If I could choose the life I please, then I would be a boatman. The life I please, then I would be a rover. And if the road was not for me, then I would take another. Across the mountains and the valleys deep, where I would take these weary feet. If I could choose the life I please, then I would be a rover. These things are so And I wish I could choose the life I please, but I am not a free man. Others rule my destiny, but my will's never broken. I know someday I will be everything that I dreamed I'd be. And when I live the life I please, then I will be a free man. Someday I will be everything that I dreamed I'd be. And when I live the life I please, then I will be a free man. And when I live the life I please, then I will be a free man.
The waiter will be around.
Can I have a tad more of Mark's guitar, please, old chap?
You're probably wondering where the dwarf tambourine player is.
He's sitting on the chair next to the Rev.
Someone has to play wise when somebody's playing Morecambe. That's just the way it is. Got any, did you find any jokes in the crackers?
Hi, this is Krista Halsoff from Veld Architect and Our Farm. We would like to invite you to come listen to Mark Shepherd give a workshop on October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Waterloo, Ontario. You are listening to The Agriculture Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM.
Hi, this is Andrew Hunt. I'm from the University of Waterloo, and you're listening to The Agriculture Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents the primary producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the needs of society.
Okay, and thanks for listening in today, folks. It's your host, Jeff Steger, and today's guest is Tom Woodcock from Rare Charitable Research Reserve, wow, over in Blair, Ontario, and they have lots going on over there. Just a quick bit about the last song, you know, that was, I call it a folk song, folksy.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And we got a little extra on the end of that one. I guess there was a bit of promo was on after that, but that sounds like it's from a live...
it was a live show, yeah, so it. It was just okay. There between songs, chatter and jokes and... nonsense.
So we could listen to that, but instead we moved on with our show, and if you really want, we could replay it, but we'll have another couple of great songs that Tom has brought today. So let's get into a second part of our show here today, and that is a little bit about what is Rare? What would the public need to know about Rare and what you do over there that would be, that you'd like to tell the public?
Yeah. Well, Rare is a unique area in Ontario. It's we bill it as the largest urban green space in Canada. It's just a little over 900 acres in its current form. It's changed form a few times over the years. It was originally the lands associated with Crixton Manor, which is a very large old manor house built in the 1850s, and land accumulated around that manor over 150 years or so of operation, and there's some of the lands were in agriculture, and there's over the years there was some prize-winning cattle breeding going on there, and prize-winning horse breeding going on there, and and there's also some large parcels of land that largely went untouched for one reason or another, and there's even some not huge but reasonably large chunks of primary forest. In the area, and some fairly spectacular old trees, and there's some some cliff ecosystems with some interesting plants on it. And there's lots of different habitat types in those 900 acres. So the idea when the University of Guelph, which was bequeathed the manor house and ultimately decided to sell it, it was made into a charitable research reserve by a number of concerned citizens in the area who clubbed together to find a way to purchase the land and make it a charitable research reserve. And since that time, the borders have changed a little bit. I think in 2010, a fairly large portion was purchased, what we call the Thompson Tract. Mm-hmm. People who have hiked on the trails called the Grand Allée and Maple Lane behind Langdon Hall would know where the Thompson Tract is. So what buying that land did was to bring into RARE the upper portion of the Bowman Creek mm-hmm. catchment, which is a cold water stream yep. with a resident population of brook trout, mm-hmm. which is, again, a pretty uncommon thing in this part of the world.
And a very short stream, too.
Now, yeah, it's pretty short, and a lot of the streams on the land don't... There's a lot of limestone and fractured limestone there, so the neighboring catchment, Crixton Creek, it doesn't really reach the... It sort of disappears and reappears a few times, and no one's entirely sure where it goes. That's one of the things that we want to find out is trace where that water goes. But so now we've got most of the Bowman Creek catchment in as part of RARE, so we can look after it properly. But there's an awful lot of things going on there. We have the educational aspect, the Every Child Outdoors program, which gets a lot of school children in visiting mm-hmm. the outdoors and runs the eco camps in the summer, yep. Which is a great place to have your kids to learn a little bit about the natural world that they might not otherwise see. There's lots of research projects going on, restoration projects, general stewardship projects dealing with invasive plants and trying to improve various features on the landscape. Public events, lots of different things going on.
Yeah, just like you mentioned, your daughter participated in a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm, yeah and, she did a good job. Yeah.
And they have lots of outreach to schools, and RARE publishes their events a lot in local news. Boy, there'd be a website, too.
Yeah, the website is RARESites, RARESITES.org. Mm-hmm. And there's all links to all the things I just mentioned on there and probably a lot more historical information and public events, schedules, and all that sort of stuff.
And every year there's something new coming along. It was it last year or was it this year that they put the solar house up on the just down on Blair Road there for mm-hmm. a while?
Yeah, that was 2012 that construction was done. Yeah. Yeah, I know it very well because when I was doing that research on the land, that was where I had to park. I was in that parking lot. So when there was all that construction equipment in there, it made it difficult. But yeah, that was put at Springbank Farm. There's the old farmhouse there. And actually, there's something I didn't mention is the community gardens plots. Mm. There's plots that are rented to the public at nominal fees, and they can grow their own vegetables and get some support from the gardens team and some supplies and, of course, some companionship and camaraderie as well, growing their plots with their neighbors.
It's quite amazing. You know, it's just such a unique ecosystem at RARE. And on one side is the city of Cambridge, and on the north side would be, I guess it's still Cambridge.
North Dumfries most of the land is in North Dumfries.
Yeah, that's what's unusual is that the actual, even though it's right by the city and people think it's Cambridge, and in fact it is part of the township of North Dumfries, and on each side then, of course, mm-hmm. to the north is Kitchener and to the south is Cambridge. So whoever would have thought you could get a spot with so many unique features with a research base so close to major cities? Mm-hmm. Like
yeah, there's a lot of pressure. We have to be ever vigilant with the creep of the city getting closer. But
you'll know it's getting too close if you can hear the people sitting down and having supper for the night in the house next door. Not quite that close by, but
not yet. Anyway,
unique balancing act you're performing over there. It's great. So, So we got mentioned the website, and I think there's occasionally there's ads on TV or on the in the paper. Can the public get in? Like, do you have a board of directors? How can the public? They can be volunteers. How would the public get involved more than just visiting if they wanted to?
There's
donate money, I suppose, or something.
Yeah, well, donating money is of course always welcome. We are a charity, so that's how we manage to do everything that we manage to do. There is a board of directors, certainly, and typical sort of nonprofit structure, as you might expect. Volunteers, there's all kinds of things that people can volunteer at. We have quite a few volunteers in my own department, the land management department, for mm-hmm. people who are interested in doing things like planting trees or pulling out invasive plants or any number of things that go on. And there's people who can volunteer with the education, can volunteer just really anything at all. We have bookkeepers who volunteer and cleaners who volunteer and our IT guy is a volunteer. So lots of people devote lots of time in their various areas of expertise, and we're always grateful for people who help out in any way that they feel they want to.
And they can enjoy all the great things going on there too, the great trails and research stuff going on, and some well-preserved architecture there. The old slot barn is back in one mm-hmm. piece again. And so.
Yeah, and it's the hot wedding venue, apparently. It's always booked for weddings and those sorts of events.
Well, that's good.
Weekends, yeah.
A happy place.
Yeah.
All right, let's play another couple times or one more song here at this stage. We talked a little bit about the previous song, and it's sort of like a folk stuff and live performance. And what's queued up next here is "Throw Down Some Water." Tell us a little bit about what that song's about.
"Throw Some Water In" from Scratch Perry, one of the fathers of just all sorts of different types of music: father of reggae, father of hip hop. This is sort of a straight-up reggae song about water and all the good things that water can do for us in different aspects of our life. He talks about running your car and running your body and growing your garden and how water makes everything work properly.
Oh, where'd you find this one song? That's pretty cool. You must have a great collection. How big is your collection of music?
It's pretty big. Unfortunately, most of it's on tape, and the tape cassettes are slowly returning to the soil, so I have to figure out a way to get them on MP3s before they disappear completely.
Yeah. Returning to the soil, that's good. We were just talking here how things have come full circle. When Tom came to the station, one of our fellow programmers was here and looking over new releases, and the station gets lost. And my goodness, what did we see today? A 45.
45 record that came into the station, yeah. The Tubuloids.
We get a lot
of bands sent their promo copy.
We get a lot of really interesting new bands. They just love sending their stuff out to stations like ours to play them. Certainly it's good to have you on board with your great selection of songs. So let's play this next one, and then we'll be right back with some more talk with our guest Tom Woodcock from Rare. And just stay locked in, folks. It's a lovely afternoon today, and we'll see you in a short bit.
Exercise and tune up your system. this your body if you want it to function. Exercise and build up your structure. Go to sea and learn how to swim. If you can't afford up a gym, buy a piece of rope. Buy a piece of rope. Buy a skipping rope. Exercise and tune up your system. Water your garden and it will grow. Service your car and it will go. Service your body. Eat the right food. Take some tonic. Drink some fish tea. Oh, yeah. Oh, baba,
hi, this is Thomas Woodcock from the Rare Charitable Research Reserve. You're listening to the Agriculture Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents the farmer producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The WFA strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the needs of society.
Thanks for doing that, Tom.
No problem.
You'll be famous in our station for a long time. I just love playing the clips from my guests, and yours is right in there, so we'll maybe get that going before sooner than later. But that's what we're trying to do here on this radio show is bring together the interests of the needs of farmers, the needs of society, and I'm sure Rare, and hopefully you can speak to it, how that works with Rare. So, research is an important part of farming, but, you're not at war with agriculture. What does the public know about what you do there that concerns agriculture that people might not know? They might think that you're just, walking trails or something, but you are... Mm-hmm. What you're doing works along with agriculture. Is that a fair enough introduction?
It does, yeah. That's something that we're hoping to improve a little bit as time goes on over the, I guess, medium term.
Mm-hmm.
When the land first became Rare Charitable Research Reserve, there was about 400 acres, so a little less than half the property was in conventional type agriculture. It's all farmed by the same tenant farmer, which has a long relationship with both the area and with the particular parcel of land. He farms quite a bit of land in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And he grows grows corn and soybeans and wheat and fairly standard food crops for Southern Ontario. We don't have any livestock since that time. But since the charity was established, about half of that land has been taken out of production for various reasons, because we are a research reserve and one of our major mandates is to conduct research in things like ecosystem restoration and so forth. So mm-hmm. addressing some of the problems, including those that affect farmland in the area, things
like
gravel pit restoration and whatnot, which is a big, shall we say, drain on our farmland.
Well, that's a big controversy
at the moment.
Yeah.
So we've got a number of those parcels of land have either just been left to naturalize, and those were the parcels that I was working on with my pollinator research. I looked at parcels that were of different ages, so taken out of production in 2003, 2006, and 2009, and then followed the plant community and followed the pollinator community as they returned to those lands. Another big portion of it is now in a tall grass prairie restoration research project that's run out of the University of Guelph. That's an enormous area, and because there was such a large area available, they're learning some new things about sort of the size of the restoration and how size really does matter. And in the case, you know, if you have a large continuous parcel versus small fragmented parcels, where the future is going to go with agriculture at Rare is a bit up in the air at the moment. Mm-hmm. We still, of course, have the about 200 acres in production, and I'm assuming they're getting ready to be harvested right about now. I know actually the wheat was harvested a little while ago, but that's on a part of the property that doesn't have a road nearby, so people wouldn't have seen the wheat field. Excuse me, but we're hoping to sort of bring conservation and agriculture together. As we go forward in Rare, and
good news,
and look at things like how people can get sort of the type of small farms and multi-product farms off the ground. So looking with organizations like FarmStart, which teaches people who aren't necessarily in agriculture or from an agricultural background, mm-hmm. how to farm and how they can actually have a farm that they can earn a living from on just a few acres of land, growing a wide variety of crops. Yeah. And thinking of farming not as an antithesis to conservation, but sort of how it can complement conservation efforts in other areas, and hopefully improve our food system overall going forward. Because I think we,
as a result of the research there, the food production system's improved, and research shows a way of how to do things better and what to consider and not consider, and that's what you do there.
Yep, and that's what we hope to do there.
That's good for agriculture, and we hope people know that we're the agriculture community is wanting to do the right thing as and what people want, and that's how we do it with the efforts what y'all doing over there.
Yeah, there's always room for improvement, and if we can come up with a better way of doing things, then everybody will win. The farmer will win, the consumers who eat the food will win, and and the land will win.
Did you put your own garden plot in this year by any chance? I'm not there long enough to put a garden in, I guess.
No, I started on August 11th, so I have what I laughingly call my 1/10 acre spread here in the city of Waterloo, where I do grow a lot of things. Usually the birds and the squirrels get them before we get to eat most of them.
Yeah, stirring the crowd.
Yeah, yeah, we have beans and pumpkins and a few kinds of berries and tomatoes, which can't seem to escape the blight these days.
Yeah,
gooseberries, which the birds eat, and red currants, which my daughter eats when I'm not looking.
You can well attest to the difficulties of what it takes to grow things. I just can tell by the way you're speaking how tough it can be at times, and to figure out the right balance between intervention and letting things be as they may, and so on. And what do people in town ask you about when they find that you're working at Rare? Do they have any questions about agriculture? Do they have questions about, how does their garden grow? Do they have questions about what they should do about those nasty raccoons? Well, do you get agricultural questions in your day-to-day living?
I can't really say I get agricultural questions too often. people talking about Rare, they usually want to know, what on earth it is. And I guess we're part of the Ontario Land Trust Alliance, so I can tell them that we're a land trust. That's an easy way to phrase it. People don't get a lot of questions about bees and from both angles. What's wrong with the bees? Where do they go? And how can I get rid of all these damn bees? which of course people are usually talking about yellow jackets and
the wasps.
I would encourage people to unless of course you have life-threatening allergies or anything. I've always found yellow jackets are pretty easy to live with. I used to work on them from a scientific aspect years and years ago, and they're great for biocontrol. They'll eat a lot of soft-bodied defoliators, caterpillars, and beetle larvae and whatnot. They're really good at that. So,
It'd be quite the day when we can harness all these forces of nature, or at least, I shouldn't guess between a harness, is by the way, you're never going to control Mother Nature, but it's nice to be able to find over time harmonious ways to interact with the natural flow of things. I noticed on my own farm that, my goodness, there's monarch butterflies are back this year. It's such a disaster for those in 2012, that drought year. They couldn't migrate. But there's a lot of difference why it happened, but that drought was a real killer for that population, I think. But
yeah, the monarchs have, we have seen more this year. The people who study the monarchs, and there has been some monarch work at RARE, people fixing tiny short-range transmitters to monarchs and watching them move about the habitat. They only work for a couple hundred meters, I understand, but I'm sure that technology is improving like everything else. But yeah, there's, I think last year was pretty much the lowest point monarchs have ever been.
I think so, too.
People who do the research look at the coverage in their roosting areas in Mexico. So how many acres of the firs that they live in, that they roost in during the winter, are covered. And it was down, I think, less than 2 acres last year from, you know, from a historical, you know, high in the 90s and before of, you know, maybe 90 acres or more they were covering. And a lot of that is, you know, been blamed on habitat loss and loss of their food plants, which, you know, can be blamed on some of the modern agricultural practices that are maybe not so sustainable.
Well, you know, it just occurred to me something. You know, Tom, I know when we talked about on the email before, ecological goods and services, there's something we can... Anything you want to talk about in that regard? The reason why I'll tell you why I thought of it was the habitat for monarchs, that means milkweed. Milkweed doesn't grow as much as it used to because you grow corn and beans and control for those weeds. Here's my flyer on it. So ecological goods and services, good for the environment, good for everybody. Wouldn't it be good if every 100-acre farm had, you know, 1 acre set aside for milkweed? And how would you administer that? How would you cover the cost of that? Like, is that a...
Yeah, that's something, actually, if I'll go to pre-RARE days and look at the pollination, there are people... who are working on just those sorts of questions and actually doing the hard economic theory and actually crunching the numbers of, well, a lot of their work was on crops that needed pollination, insect pollination. So things like blueberries was a big one, which is...
And almonds.
Yeah, we don't really have much in the way of almonds here. But in Canada, the number one and the number two crops in terms of honeybee use are canola and blueberries. So those two crops, people, the honeybees can do the job, but maybe if we have some habitat set aside to support native bees and also to support honeybees, because honeybee management is sort of needs some updating itself. Honeybees have some dietary problems and nutrition problems. And so if we set aside this land and we don't have to spend as much money on pollination contracts, because the price of pollination is going up in terms of renting honeybee hives and having beekeepers bring their hives in, and because they're becoming scarcer. So, and it's been demonstrated in terms of things like canola, you know, if you set aside this land for the bees, you don't have to manage that land. You can get a greater yield off the land that you are cultivating, and overall, the net profit, not necessarily the net yield of the whole farm, but the net profit for the farmer is larger. And that that work with canola was done by someone named Laura Morandon in the U.S. Even though I believe she is Canadian, she did some of her education at the University of Guelph.
Well, that makes it interesting. So what he's thinking is that if they could actually put honeybees on those farms, they could actually make money from it, and they wouldn't be out the cost of being one less acre of canola. Is that the trade-off? Did I follow that right?
That's it's really just they wouldn't have to rent the bees, because some crops, so. You know, they take a huge number of bees. Good example is cranberry, which is not grown extensively, but cranberry as a crop, bees don't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes after bees have been put on cranberry, they have to be put on at such high densities that basically they'll forage on those plants they don't like as much. So really they get, the hive is damaged after it's been on cranberry for a while just because they're so crowded together. So they usually have to go through sort of a rehab after they've been on cranberry. And one would think that, you know, if there was some better forage there for them, that maybe they could, their health could be improved. Or maybe those wild bees that do like cranberry could be encouraged and the honeybees could be used elsewhere on a crop that keeps them healthier.
Boy, there's a lot of room in between the extremes where the discussion is polarized between, you know, the honeybees are dying and it's all agriculture's fault. There's a lot of subtleties and nuances in there, isn't there?
Yeah, there really is. It ranges from, you know, are we putting honeybees on these crops just out of habit, or and then there's things, you know, the latest fact sheet from the Ministry of Agriculture, or the current fact sheet, I should say, controlling for corn earworm suggests that you spray for the corn earworm while the corn's in tassel. Well, that means it's flowering. So
the bees would be there
collecting the corn pollen. And,
yeah.
And the label, of course, says do not spray on flowering plants. So obviously there's some confusion there. People don't quite know what to do, and mistakes happen. And it's things like that that, you know, are at least partly responsible for honeybee kills.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all good news. There's another whole show in there, and right now in Ontario, of course, and all across North America, basically, is the debate on pollinators, especially honeybees. So we'll probably have more shows than that in the future, and I'm glad for your comments. It's all part of this as we get to that final result, whether it's not likely to be a total ban, but it certainly won't be steady as she goes. There will be changes.
Mm.
You know, we're just whipping right along here, Tom, and it's time to play that last song before we do our wrap-up.
Okay.
And this is the New Model Army. And what the heck's a New Model Army?
It's kind of interesting. I'm really gonna sound like an egghead here. New Model Army was a phrase that was first used in the preaching of the First Crusade.
Oh my goodness.
Why do I know that? Because my art selective in university was on medieval European history, and I actually wrote my term paper on the preaching of the First Crusade by Pope Urban I. But anyway, it's also a name that was
very
taken by a band.
Yes, okay.
To describe a new type of force in the world, I guess. and this song is similar to Boatman. It's about how to better live your life.
All right, we'll play that. My apologies for our live listeners today. My computer seems to be pausing before we play the song. I'll edit that out for the podcast. But here we go, the New Model Army. You're listening to the Agriculture Show, episode number 90, and with my guest today, Tom Woodcock from Rare. We'll be right back with a little wrap-up. See you shortly.
Two, one! I'm Mark Wales from the Ontario Federation of Agriculture. You're listening to the Agriculture Show on CKMS Radio 100.3 Sound FM. The Agriculture Show is brought to you by the Waterloo Federation of Agriculture. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture represents the primary producers in the region of Waterloo. Our goal is to promote the farm community in support of the innovation, hard work, and compassion that is emblematic of the region of Waterloo. The Waterloo Federation of Agriculture strives to bring together the policy needs of the farmer with the needs of society.
Well, holy smokes, Tom, we are at the end of an hour. I don't know where the time goes. You've got so many different things to talk about and interesting conversations. So we'll look forward to having yourself back or some others from Arrere and continuing our conversations. We should probably just do a little wrap-up at the moment and kind of cover off a few things that we did during the show today. And just great to get to know you better. You've got a long history. You're living in Waterloo and a long history all over the world, it seems. You're a world traveler. Do you see yourself as a world traveler with all your training?
Well, maybe northeastern North America. I've done some, the other place I've done research is Churchill, Manitoba area in Wapusk National Park.
What are we doing up there?
Worked with insect biodiversity, plant biodiversity, pollination, maybe a little dabbling in climate change, as it's a little more noticeable up there than it is down here.
Did you take a little bit of a polar bear evasion techniques up there?
Only once was a little too close to a polar bear, but they're not particularly interested in us. We're more like a cat, a toy to a cat, than really food. Sort of. If they smack us, we make a funny noise, and that's about it.
That's about it. Well,
we mean no harm.
And you're living in Waterloo and driving down to Cambridge on Blair Road to work, and 6 weeks now you've been there?
6 weeks, yeah. August 11th was my first day.
That's quite amazing. You really fit right in real quick, and they put you to work and put you on the radio show. A good thing you were not afraid to take up the challenge. I think I hope it was as fun as I think it was.
I've had a great time, no doubt.
And then we talked a little bit about Arrere, I'm just going to take a guess. It's like 15 years, right? How long has Arrere been there?
They've been 2001.
2001. So, just always growing. Started out as an idea and. The first steps were taken when the land was purchased from the University of Guelph. It had been a research farm before that. I should mention that when I graduated from Guelph in 75, it was actually still a working research farm. But at that point, they were trying to decide what to do with it long term. So. Mm. So anyway, 2001, there they had the property. And ever since then, every year, there seems to be a little bit more going on. And up these years, the long-term studies are coming to some fruition. You're busy looking at how... prairie grass restoration works.
Yeah, tall grass prairie.
Yeah. Tall grass prairie. Yeah, that tall grass. Yeah,
used to be a common habitat in southern Ontario. Well, fairly common. There was lots of prairie pockets, and of course, when colonization started, those were the low hanging fruit for farming. Mm-hmm. So those were the first ones to go under the plow, and a lot of the species that lived there are now in a bit of trouble, particularly the birds. Mm. The grassland birds are the most threatened group in Ontario, simply due to habitat loss. So we're trying to do some restoration at Arrere. We've got bobolink, which is sort of the flagship prairie dwelling species. They nest on the ground, and we do have a hay field right now where they're nesting, and we've pretty much found that if I think the data is that if you can delay mowing your hay from, late June to maybe the first or second week of July, you can improve their reproductive success by 70%. So it's just a small thing we can do to help some of the birds, and that's another opportunity for research there. They've just
that would be good research, because I don't think there's a landowner or farmer in Ontario that doesn't want to support habitat, but it's certainly the problem then. Is that hay quality declined so much in those 2 weeks? And should that landowner bear the responsibility for the protecting the species, or should it be society's responsibility?
Yeah, well, it's certainly is society's responsibility to some degree, because we all You know, we all use ecological goods and services that are provided by land, whether mm-hmm. that land is public or private. It's not something that you can draw a dividing line at. But as you say, there's another possible area for research is looking at at hay species, you know, or cultivars of the hay plants that maybe you can delay a couple weeks
and not be financially worse mm-hmm. off. I think that's the issue, right? That like mm-hmm. for the agriculture guys, you know, sustainability means can you make a living and raise your family and send them to school. And so, you know, it doesn't really matter if the hay does get too mature, but you still got to be able to make a living somehow. So like research to do that would be just great. Then mm-hmm. we'd preserve habitat, and the farmer could go about his business and look forward to a good career.
yeah. If we can improve sustainability, that'll benefit all of us. And so we're not losing our natural capital and the quality of that natural capital, and we can always manage it better, and we can always improve the productivity and the yield, while at the same time, you know, doing a better job of stewardship on that land. So hopefully some of our research at RARE will enable us to do that, whether it's directly looking at alternative agriculture systems and sustainable agriculture systems, or looking at other types of studies on the land and land restoration.
Yeah, you mentioned during a short break there that there was, is there something new and cutting that we could talk about as far as, we started talking about pollinators. Was that what you were mentioning in the break there? I hate to put you in the spot.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking more about, we were previously talking about ecological goods and services and pollinators, and I think while I'm speaking to people, it would be remiss of me not to point out some of the current issues with pesticides mm-hmm. and how in the 90s and 80s and into the 90s, there was a big push to use pesticides as little as possible. You know, there was things that were being pushed, like pest scouting and economic action thresholds, where you don't spray until there's a problem that's going to cause economic loss to the farmer. And since that time, I think there's a number of forces that have sort of really changed that paradigm, and now we have what we would call prophylactic pesticide use, where virtually every kernel of every seed of corn, every kernel of corn that's planted in Ontario is coated with an insecticide. And this is one of the things that Roundup Ready crops as well. You know, we're spraying for those weeds. Do we really need to spray for those weeds? Are they causing economic loss to the crop that exceeds the cost of the spray? And in a lot of cases, in both of those situations, I think the answer is probably no. And there's been some research done. I have seen unpublished research from people in Quebec that have looked at corn yields in using untreated seed versus treated seed, and they concluded that the treated seed is really only needed in about 30% of cases, and the rest of the time it's just superfluous. So the canary in the coal mine, I suppose, has been bees, and whether the bees are getting taking up the insecticide through water or from planter dust, which is another method of delivery that's been cited as a problem. But there's also other organisms that provide our goods and services, organisms that process organic matter in the soil and cycle nutrients, and, you know, the earthworms and, mm-hmm. and the beetles and all these other organisms, things that may be predators of the pests that we're trying to control. The insecticides in question, neonicotinoid insecticides, are non-specific, and they can be very, very toxic to certain organisms. Mm-hmm.
To put in a proper framework there, this is not a new thing. Like, we used an older generation of pest controls, particularly organophosphates, which are toxic to humans as well. Mm-hmm. And so we've been poisoning bugs ever since we grew crops. But over the time, it's getting better, because the latest crop, the neonics, still kill insects, but they don't kill people. And that's it's deemed as such to be the latest evolution of it. So look, the industry side can probably figure out something in the long term, because it'd be better to have an insecticide that gets at only the target problems, not as the bees or other helpful insects.
Yeah, I think we could go a long way if we only used those products when they were needed and when we could empirically determine that they're required. That's the low hanging fruit, I think. Know.
Well, the trouble is it's not low hanging, because from what I understand, there's not a good test for it. The tests are empirical, where you actually measure the amount of eggs in the soil that could hatch out into the particular things, which would set a threshold. And the other thing is, weather modeling, which would suggest that if the weather is a certain situation, then the population will explode or not explode. So the research is the point. Mm-hmm. With more research, that would be really great to know when you could be, even if you get the, you know, let's say only 30% of the fields, if you still only treated 50% of the fields, you'd have reduced the amount of insecticide a lot. It's not perfect yet.
Any improvement will help. There's lots of research that can be done looking at crop rotation strategies to make sure that when the pests emerge, there's nothing for them to eat.
Yeah,
that next year, and all kinds of different things that we can do. But if there's damage being caused off farm to, you know, the things that clean our water and
they're not good,
and make sure our other types of ecosystems are functioning properly, then that's not good.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Those types of decisions, that some of the research you're doing now, you're skilled especially at that, they're answering some of those questions. Like, you see yourself as being part of that solution.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think the best thing that we can do is get those answers, and, you know, we can't do anything without without good information, and I think that there's certain forces who don't want some of those questions answered, because it would negatively impact them. But if you have good information, then that's the best you can do. The answer may be.
I agree. It's not appropriate for a knee jerk reaction just to say you can't use them whatsoever. It's just how you're using them, and if the damage was 30%, 30% of the field needs spray or the insecticide, then you would still be allowed to use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
if it was using it properly and appropriately and at the right time, I think is the very first step we need to take. So.
Then that's the best part. Not this prophylactic buckshot approach. More pinpoint. Yeah, well, it's a big job, Tom. Are you going to be able?
It is a big job.
I have confidence you can add your two cents to that conversation. That'd be great. Before we go, tell us about that last song. Can we get our heads wrapped around it? There, we talked a little bit about it. You brought a wide variety of music, and that was quite fun to listen to. That was the New Model Army. Yeah. Now, are they a new age band? What do they build themselves at?
They sort of grew out of post punk in the UK. Their first record, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think it was 84 or 85. They had a lot of politically and human rights. Political and human rights related sort of themes to their songs. You probably noticed some of the lyrics in that last song about the government watching and making sure we're all watching TV and talking about stupid crap and not dealing with the real issues.
Were they pre-internet days band?
Oh yeah.
Did they foresee the future?
I'm not even 100% sure if they're still active. They might be, but they're, I say 1985 till now. That's a long time for any band. So
the only thing that time was, the Fahrenheit 451 predicting the mind control over the population. Don't read books or you shall be corrupted type thing. And this band is talking about that. If I wanted to, paraphrase them too quickly, but then nowadays it's the internet. It's read today in the paper about how the new search engines and algorithms they use on the major social media, the major websites, you know, the YouTubes and so on, Google. It's quite a
line I love in that song is the golden age of communication means everyone talks at the same time. And that's, I think we have a lot of that today. Nobody's listening, but there's a lot of talking going on.
So what do you do in a quiet time when you just want to relax? Are you a musician by chance, or are you a craft person?
I am almost completely musically inept. Well, a long time ago, I tried my hand with friends who were much better musically at me to sort of, I don't know, bang a drum or bang on a keyboard in the background of their bands, but it never really took. My friends who were musicians would take me along with a video camera to film their performances. That was my contribution. What do? I like to read. I like to play soccer. If I can't play soccer, I like to watch soccer. There's other sports I like to watch as well. Baseball and hockey, probably the two biggies. Gardening, of course, is a big one for me. Don't do as much as I should, but I like to watch things grow. I don't like to do the work involved, I suppose.
Well, it can be quite an effort. You know, often gardeners are either pleasantly surprised or just heartbroken with the way that particular year's combination of weather and insects is treated their garden. So hopefully most of the time you win, so it's some gratification from it.
Yeah, I don't worry too much about insects. They can usually eat what they want, but I like to watch them.
Yeah. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Tom. We just covered a whole whack of stuff here. Thanks again for coming out today.
My pleasure. It's been great.
And, go over to Rare and see what's going on, folks. Websites out there, and they have a whole bunch of events going on for young and old and research and the rest of it. And you can go over there and talk to Tom and ask him about what he said in the radio show.
Absolutely, yep.
Where's your office? Are you in the old Blair Tavern down there?
The 1679 Blair Road, the old Lamb's Inn, or originally Lamb's Inn, most recently Nicholson's Tavern.
Nicholson's Tavern, yes, I know that quite well.
A lot of people know it by.
Yep.
That's our headquarters. So if you're interested in volunteering or picking up some literature or brochures or talking to people, just that's where you can find us.
All right. So with that, folks, just to bid you all have a great afternoon for us this afternoon, and just thanks so much for listening in. We'll be back next week with either a new show or a podcast from before. Stay tuned, and if you ate today, thank a farmer, and we'll see you in 120 hours. We got that right? Anyway, thanks again, Tom. We'll see you later, and we'll see you later, folks. Bye for now.